It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Hello, good day. It is November 30th. It's the last day of the World Vegan Month. I can't believe it's going to be over, but that doesn't mean that after November 30th we can't continue on the path to celebrate plant foods and why we love them so much. Not only are they delicious, but they're gentler on the planet than the production of animals for food, and they're also a lot nicer all around. Now, I talk about a lot of things on this show. Of course, it's always related to food, my favorite subject. And we talk about the devastation of the environment, and we talk about the horrifically cruel animal agriculture. But for the next 3 weeks, it's party time here. It's only celebration talking about healthy, delicious foods, because in time for the holidays, I want to give you lots of options and lots of ideas, and there's something for everyone. So we're going to start with a topic that's becoming more and more prevalent, and it has to do with allergies. And we have Lori Sadowski, and she has a new book out called Allergy-Free Cook, Bake, Spread. She's a certified personal trainer and nutrition and wellness specialist, food writer, and musicologist. She spends her time spreading awareness about balanced living, cooking and baking, and continuing her research in modern music and art. Welcome to It's All About Food, Lori.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you, and thanks for all of the creative work that you've been doing. So I know you're a bit of an artist because you're involved in modern music and art, but food is also an art.
Yes, I definitely agree with that, and I'm definitely very creative when it comes to it.
Yeah, and it's a good thing because people appreciate delicious, beautiful food. There's no question about it. And sometimes we have to get really creative, especially when starting to eliminate things.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, when you're I have celiac disease, and when you're diagnosed with celiac or any food allergies, and then you add, you know, being a vegan or a vegetarian to the mix, you really have to think outside the box in order to eat what you want.
Mm-hmm. But the good news is you can do it.
Yes. That's very true.
Yeah, and I've been doing a lot of gluten-free baking, vegan baking, and I'm having a great time with it. I don't necessarily have to do it, but I'm really enjoying it and discovering, I've said this before, but as when I eliminate foods, all of a sudden I find the door opens and I have more variety than ever.
That's definitely something very true, and I write that in my book that we often, when we don't have restrictions, we think, you know, what do we use? Butter, eggs, flour, and everyone asks me all the time, how do you bake without eggs,
mm-hmm.
or how do you bake without butter or flour? And I say, well, you know, there's actually about 23 gluten-free flours that are common. That's not even the ones that aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's so many options to switch out the eggs or the milk or the butter and stuff like that.
Okay, let's back up a little bit, and can you share a little history about how you discovered you had celiac disease?
Yeah, for sure. I, like most people, I didn't ever feel quite well. I had a lot of gastrointestinal problems growing up, and just things didn't seem right, but to me, I thought it was normal. I thought that was just how you were supposed to feel. And then when I went away to university, I just started feeling sicker and sicker, and I suddenly started losing rapid amounts of weight. I lost 60 pounds in just a few months. I was getting a lot of neurological problems. I didn't know whether to chalk it up to, you know, being in university, just maybe not taking care of yourself as well as when you were younger or if you were an adult. And but then it just started getting frightening as I was losing the weight and having up to 20 bowel movements a day.
Whoa.
And I ended up being diagnosed with celiac.
You know, it's important to talk about it for a lot of different reasons, but not everyone experiences the same symptoms, so it's a little more challenging than other things for the doctor to know or for you to know what it is that you have. And I think
it definitely can be difficult.
Yeah, and it affects different people differently, where some people all of a sudden are devastated with this problem, and for others it gets progressively worse over time.
Mm-hmm.
Some
for
people
sure.
are diagnosed as a child, and some people don't have it until, I mean, they can be perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden as an adult all these problems start happening. And so it's really important to talk about it. What surprises me, and maybe it's because the symptoms vary, that doctors still are misdiagnosing it and are not testing people right away for celiac disease.
No, and, you know, it's become so much more common. I mean, we hear about it a lot more,
mm-hmm.
and we see a lot more products on the shelves, but doctors are still, you get a lot of it's in your head,
mm-hmm.
or it's stress, or it's IBS, and these are all blanket terms for saying, we don't know what's wrong with you, and let's just see if it goes away first. And
yeah.
that's too bad, because people don't feel well. And you know, it could for some people be stress, because stress can affect your gastrointestinal system, for sure. However, for people who are going through debilitating symptoms, it's probably not stress.
Right. And, you know, it's, well, I don't know. I'm not a medical doctor, and I imagine it's pretty challenging, especially today with our crazy healthcare programs and insurance, and it's probably pretty stressful there. But still, this is something, you know, I'm thinking kids in public school should be tested every year for celiac disease just to know. There were three articles recently in the New York Times about celiac disease, and one just came out like 5 days ago. And it just, number one, I'm surprised that doctors don't catch it right away. But then some people tend to be a little glib about it. And Michael Pollan recently wrote an article in the New York Times, and he said he was dubious about all of these gluten intolerance and gluten allergies. And there's nothing dubious about it. It's a serious disease, and a lot of people have it.
And I think that the issue there is that a lot of people, like, I mean, we've heard some celebrities who go gluten-free and talk about it like a diet, and
yeah.
that's almost, it's almost difficult for a celiac to hear, because we need to be taken seriously when we go to places. And I don't really eat at restaurants. I'm scared to.
Mm-hmm.
I was very sick at some point. But some people do eat at restaurants liberally. And if they say, you know, I have celiac, it's very serious, one crouton in my salad could make me very sick, cross-contamination is a big deal, but then there's a stigma going around that it's a diet and it's a fad, then that's difficult. And I think that him being dubious shouldn't be of the amount of diagnoses there are, but instead the amount of people maybe who say they need to eat gluten-free
mm-hmm.
and want to, and maybe they do feel better, and that's fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with eliminating it from your diet if you don't feel well when you eat it, but being laid back about it can cause a concern, just like any food allergy.
Well, one thing that I recently read that I was surprised that, because I didn't know, is that even a healthy intestine doesn't completely break gluten down. So all of us, even those who don't have celiac or any type of wheat intolerance, still cannot completely break it down. And I think there's a clue there that, you know, there are shades of gray. And putting celiac aside, I do believe that lots of different people have issues because we don't digest gluten. well?
Well, there was an article written last year in a medical journal, and they had discovered that there is such thing as gluten intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the same response in the body as celiac does, but it does have a different response as opposed to showing nothing, where like they say, well, then, you know, maybe you just don't want to eat it, but it did show that there's actual intolerance to gluten that people can have that isn't celiac. And I mean, I think that that's a huge red flag, because it's just like, I mean, and also I'm also not a doctor, but there's lots of proof that a gluten and casein free diet helps children with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And now that may work for half the kids, and that may work for half of them and not the other half, but the half that it does work for, well,
why not?
Significant.
It's very significant.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to lose.
That's
other
right.
than the possibility of not eating gluten again, which doesn't have to be that big of a deal.
So people talk about how difficult eating can be, one, if you're a vegan, two, if you're gluten-free. Personally, myself, as a vegan, I don't find it difficult at all, especially I started on this path decades ago, and it's so easy now just because the word is in the vocabulary. They talk about it on TV shows. They make fun of us. They embrace us. There's all these great products out. And celiac, too, okay, there are issues in restaurants because you can't. It's hard to trust.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certainly more products and more knowledge coming out about it.
Oh, definitely. It's even in 5 years for me, or 6 years now, I can't even believe that there was nothing on the shelves when I was diagnosed. And especially, I mean, I'm in Canada, so things are a lot slower here. I can't believe that there's sections and aisles dedicated to gluten-free. It blows my mind.
So let's talk about the fun part. So there's a lot of great things that you can make that don't require wheat, and I'm talking about baked goods primarily because that's where the challenge is. So do you have any favorite flours you like to work with?
Yeah, definitely. I love sorghum flour. I use it sort of as a base flour and then build and use other flours on top of that. Sorghum flour is pretty high in protein, it's high in fiber, and it's more of a whole grain. And just if, say, I could eat wheat, I would never use all-purpose regular white flour. It lacks all the nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So similar, I bake gluten-free. I don't want to use something like white rice flour that lacks nutrition. So I was trying to seek something that still delivered like a nice flavor without being heavy or taste whole grain and hearty, but give you that nutrition too. So like the perfect balance. I love sorghum for that.
Mm-hmm. Do you make up with sorghum in it, or you add some other things to it?
And then depending on the recipe, I add other flours. Gluten-free baking works best with a mix of flours and sometimes some starches. So in addition to sorghum, I sort of mix and match between other ones. I like quinoa flour because it's very high in protein, and it binds things together. It helps bind things together really well because of its protein content. It's also very good for you. I mean, we hear it all the time now how nutritious quinoa is. Teff is another one, which is an ancient Ethiopian grain that is also very high in protein and delivers sort of an earthy flavor, so it's nice for loaves of bread and
savory food.
Anything where you want to give that almost that comforting, earthy, hearty taste to. Rustic, that's the word I'm looking for. Bread aside, I like millet flour for anything that's cakey or cupcakes or anything like cinnamon rolls that are a little bit lighter and you want that tenderness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Millet flour is really nice for that.
Mm.
And those are a whole grain, which is why I like to use them.
Right. The teff flour I've had in Ethiopian cooking. They make what do they call it? It's like a pancake. They don't use forks or knives, and they use this pancake to scoop up everything, and it has a nice foamy texture and a great flavor.
Yeah, it's fermented. When you make it, it's fermented for a few days. So, I mean, obviously our teff grain that we get here probably isn't nearly what they have in Ethiopia. But unfortunately, a lot of restaurants who use it mix it with wheat flour on this side. So it's still not gluten-free.
Right. And that makes me think of something. Now, let's say a lot of times when you have specific food needs and you've got friends and family who care about you, they want to prepare something that meets your needs. And as a vegan, it's okay. I mean, sometimes they say, oh, I put a little butter in it, and they don't realize that even a little is not acceptable. But when it comes to being completely gluten-free, how do you handle that? Do other people ask, you know, if you're going to an event, can I make you something, or do you just bring your own food?
I usually just bring my own because it's easier. It's easier for me. It's easier for them. I don't have to worry. And I always appreciate, I mean, everyone always asks, and I always appreciate it. But really, I don't mind packing a dinner. So, I mean, and that then they don't have to fret. I don't have to worry. I guess I've never been in a situation where it was a huge concern. Even a wedding, I once packed a dinner, and it wasn't a big deal. And when I eat with my parents, I usually just make a dinner. If it's an event like Christmas or something like that, I just bring some stuff, or we talk about it before and we see what can be done. But usually I just bring it to make things easier.
There are more places that are gluten-free or have certifications that, especially by people who have celiac disease and they're creating businesses, so you can have a little more trust in what's going on. I don't know about Canada. I know in New York we have places.
Oh, well, I mean, New York would be a dream. If I went to New York, I'm sure I'd eat my way through it.
Yeah.
I'm not too far out of Toronto, and Toronto is quite accessible for me. And although I'm quite a distance from Ottawa, Ottawa is good, too. I live in a smaller area. But, I mean, I also live quite close to the border, so if I do need groceries or anything, it's very easy for me to hop over and remember how much more you guys have. But there is definitely some things here that are easy to get, and some restaurants, especially raw vegan restaurants, are usually gluten-free, so I'm confident with eating at those. There are a handful of others, and there's one place in my city.
Right. I didn't think about that, but there's an advantage of crossover vegan diets where the raw wouldn't have wheat. What about traveling? Now, you have a website, which is your name, Lori Sadowski. I'm looking at lorisadowski.wordpress.com. And
LoriSadowski.com just goes right to
gets to it. And you have some tips about traveling through Walt Disney World. How is it traveling?
You know, I don't travel too much, and usually if I do, it's been in my car, so I'll pack a cooler or know which grocery stores, or if I'm staying in a hotel, I try to get one with a kitchenette or minimally a refrigerator. Disney World was literally, amazing. Anyone who wants to eat well, just go to Disney World, because you'll eat better than you'll ever have to. Their allergy protocol is intense. But I've never had a problem because I've always organized it beforehand. But I've never done anything where I've traveled to Europe or anywhere since I've been diagnosed, where I've had to really do a lot of details as opposed to somewhere drivable or where I can just access a grocery store easily. But beforehand, I always scope out restaurants in the area, get on the internet, Google gluten-free, say Cleveland, gluten-free Cleveland, or vegan Cleveland, and I try to mix and match, and then I make a lot of phone calls because that's the only way I'm going to know.
Yeah, you do.
It just requires a lot of planning.
Yeah, you do have to do some planning, but I want to say fortunately, because it is becoming so popular, there are certainly everywhere more and more places that will be gluten-free friendly.
Yeah, and usually they know what it means, mm-hmm. which, I mean, if you said it 6 years ago, they wouldn't. Sometimes, I guess the difficulty is the combination of gluten-free and vegan.
Because, let's talk about that. That seems to be extra super challenging for some, and they might tend to, if they were vegan, kind of allow some eggs and dairy into their life just because it's so challenging.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that, just like with anything, you have to pre-plan, and you do have to, I think in this case, like to cook a little bit. I mean, you could get away with some things off the shelves, but for the most part, they're not super nutritious, and
right.
I mean, you can't eat some of the proteins because you can't eat anything with gluten in it, and you would definitely need to be a little bit experimental in the kitchen. But other than that, as long as you're eating a wide variety of foods, I mean, if you think, okay, what can I eat? White rice, peanut butter, apple juice. I mean, that's not going to be nutritious for you. That's not going to be nutritious for anyone. But if you think of all the different grains like quinoa and pef and millet and buckwheat, and as well as rice and wild rice, and then you can maybe bake a little to be able to have some sandwiches and treats when you want them, and then focus on the other things like legumes and nuts and seeds and things that you should be eating as a vegan, so you're getting all your amino acids and then you're getting your healthy fats, then you can easily round it out. But it does require a little bit of thinking outside the box and being open to new flavors and new tastes, because chances are you'll try some things you probably haven't before.
Well, I'm not going to say that it would be a good thing if everybody had celiac disease, but but there are positive things to it, and I'm always telling people to get back into the kitchen, and sometimes it takes something very serious to get people back into the kitchen. Many people have different debilitating diseases, chronic diseases, and find that they can't eat properly in restaurants or with prepared foods, and they learn how to cook, and they learn what they need to do, and it all requires getting back into the kitchen and learning about whole foods, and it really is simple when you get to it. But I think, you know, anything that gets people back into the kitchen is a good thing.
And I totally agree. I mean, I didn't really cook much before I was diagnosed, because I was in my early 20s and I was a university student, and I made a lot of canned soups and you know, just basic sandwiches. I made chocolate chip cookies. That was pretty much all I baked. It was chocolate chip cookies. And I realized, like, if I'm going to do this, I have to start learning how to cook, because I don't ever want to miss out on one food that I liked before.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things can be, I mean, certain things are a little more frustrating than others, because things that are vegan that would be lovingly convenient aren't gluten-free, and vice versa. But in general, I never really miss anything. I just have to try to recreate it instead.
Yeah, well, I'm looking on your website, and there's a recipe index. Is this all the recipes that are in your book?
There's a recipe index on the website that is just like my blog recipe index,
okay.
But then there's an area on my website called the Allergy Free Cook Baked Bread,
mm-hmm.
And
I'm looking at it.
Readers click on that, then there's a table of contents, so you can see all the different recipes that are in the first book, because this is a series of books that is coming out. The next one is Allergy Free Cook Bakes Cakes and Cookies. And so this one is the all the breads and the muffins, cinnamon rolls, pizza, pizza crust, stuff like that. And that's all under the allergy-free cook baked spread area of the book with the table contents.
So, this is a series because there are just so many things that need to be in each book that you need in more than one book.
Yeah, well, at first it was maybe the plan my plan was having a huge book with everything, and then we thought, you know what, let's get let's get the breads down pat here. Let's get the things that people miss most, because if you're diagnosed with celiac and you're a vegan, most breads at the supermarket are either not very tasty or void of any sort of nutrition with lots of white rice flour and potato starch, and or they're not vegan. The few that are good, I've actually never had them, but I've read reviews, have eggs in them.
Yep.
And even there's a gluten-free bakery in Toronto that once I called and I said, do your breads have eggs? Because I was going to be in Toronto for the day, and I thought I would get a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
I just asked if they were vegan, and he said, oh, come on, they can't be made without eggs.
Whoa.
And I was like, wait a second. And I was just like, oh, okay, thank you. But I thought to myself, but they can.
They can. I know, because I make them here at home, too, and they're really good once you know what to do, and it's not that complicated. Do you have any plan on having a vegan gluten-free bakery?
You know, I've definitely thought about it a lot, and I really enjoy what I'm doing, and I really love making the recipes, and I wouldn't even mind if I was in a bakery part-time, but I think that if I did it all the time, I don't know if I would if I'd have the time to experiment and build new ideas, and because I'd be always supplying my bakery, I'm not sure if I would want it as a full-time thing, because I enjoy it so much right now. I really like how it's panning out as a writer.
You know, it's hard work having a restaurant or having a food business, so you have to really, really, really want to do it. But there's no question that the need is out there.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I think breads are probably the hardest. So the next book you're coming out with is Cookies and Cakes.
Yes.
That's a little easier, isn't it?
You know, I thought it would be. But then when I realized that I wanted... obviously I come up with the vast majority of recipes by myself, and I just experiment and come up with new tastes and ideas, but there's certain staples you need in your repertoire, like a chocolate cake and and the yellow cake and stuff like that. And to perfect some of those, both vegan and gluten-free and whole grain and no refined sugars, was so important to me that I would never settle if it was just good or even if it was great. I wanted it to taste excellent.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people around me were inundated with lots and lots of, how good is it? Do you like it? Do you think it tastes regular? Do you think it tastes normal? Because I would want to make sure that it was what we remembered and it wasn't just something that seemed like a bit of a knockoff.
When you say no refined sugars, what are you using?
It depends on the recipe, but I primarily use, unrefined cane sugar or evaporated cane juice, like coconut.
Yeah.
But I also really use agave nectar and maple syrup. I love maple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say those are the primary ones that I use, and molasses. So they just are a mix and match of those. The only other one I sometimes use, which is refined, is icing or confectioner's sugar. We call it icing sugar here. And that's like, you know, for decoration. So the rest of the stuff is all unrefined. And even though calorie for calorie, it's all pretty much the same as regular sugar. And you know, sugar is sugar is sugar. But at least you're getting some of the nutrients.
Sure. Well, I think it's ambitious, and I know it can be done, and I look forward to seeing that book as well. So, Lori, thank you for everything that you've done and for these great recipes. I know that many, many people are going to benefit from this work. And
thank you.
I look forward to the next one. So your website, again, is lorisadowski.com. The book is Allergy-Free Cook Bakes Bread.
Yes.
And There we go. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Have a great day.
Have a great day.
Okay, we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be right back to talk more about delicious food. I'm Karen Hartglass. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Because it is. It's all about food. I bet everything that you think of, I could find a connection to food. And I love talking about it. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier in the show, for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be talking not only about food, my favorite subject, but about delicious variations on a theme, all kinds of great recipes for any time of the year, but especially for the holiday season. People like to start talking about recipes and things, and so the next one we're going to be talking about is the Blooming Platter Cookbook with author Betsy DeJulio. Betsy, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thanks so much, Karen. It's an honor.
Thank you. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
It's actually, it looks exactly like you said it, but it's actually pronounced DeJulio.
DeJulio. Okay. Well, noted.
Well, my father-in-law, my husband is Italian on both sides, and my father-in-law changed the spelling, so you pronounce it exactly like it looks.
Okay. Was it originally a G, maybe?
It was.
Yeah.
It was, and everybody pronounced it with a hard G sound, and so he just thought it was easier to change the spelling.
And look at that. Here we are in this very Spanish-oriented speaking
exactly.
country, and
exactly.
so much for that. You may have to make it like DIGUILIO.
Yes,
that was,
but
that's how I
know
was
I'm a teacher, so I answer to anything, and some of my students call me DeJulio, so
uh-huh.
it's all good.
Well, how about just Betsy?
Yep, that's great.
Okay. Well, let's see. Did I read about you here? The author of the Blooming Platter Cookbook, A Harvest of Seasonal Vegan Recipes. You're an artist, journalist, teacher, and innovator in vegan cooking. And according to this little bio that I'm reading, your concept of seasonality can be of audience interest for winter cooking. Excellent for spring and summer and fall, too. Topical four times a year, as the recipes in your book take the guesswork out of using the freshest seasonal produce.
I don't know, Karen. It sounds like you're talking about somebody else.
In creating additional recipes. Well, no, it's good.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, so you've got this lovely book out, and great title, because vegan food is beautiful and full of color.
Isn't it? Or it should be, right?
It should be. You know, so many of the foods people eat today are white, tan, bland, gray, brown, loaded with salt, sugar, and fat.
You're absolutely right. I think as an art teacher, we all eat with our eyes. I guess that's sort of a cliche at this point. But as an art teacher, I may be even more attuned to color and that type of thing. And I've tried some new things this season just based on how attractive they were to look at. Like, I had no idea you could actually cook and eat a Turk's turban squash. And I had driven past our, local farmer's market, and they just had a sea of these pumpkins that were oranges and greens and striped and polka dot. I whipped in, and one of the people that works there said that an older customer had been in and was telling him how you could roast these Turk's turbans. And, of course, you can. So a whole new world has opened up to me just based on, color, like you said. It's so enticing.
Well, I don't know if you've experienced this. I know I have. I've been doing this vegan thing for decades, and and I'm not quiet about it. And in the corporate world, when I would go to meetings where food was served, I was always making sure that there was something for me to eat. And sometimes mm-hmm. that meant talking to people in advance.
Sure.
That which is helpful. But then I would be served my plate, and all the attention was on me, because everything I got, even it was the simplest often, because, people didn't know what to do, but they would serve me beautiful colors, fresh fruits,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was like, oh,
and
how did you get that?
Right, and probably far more than you could ever eat in one sitting.
Yeah.
I know when I get the classic vegetable platter out, like you're talking about, it's enough to feed five people. I think they think because the poor child is not eating meat, she couldn't possibly be satisfied.
Well, that's true some of the time, because you could go to a restaurant sometimes and order sides, and they're mm-hmm. tremendously small.
Right.
Because
that's
they're
true.
Sides, mm-hmm. and I don't know.
Yeah, it's more that buffet setting. I mean, not buffet, the banquet
yeah.
setting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the other thing about it is often there's a lot of raw food, crudité, mm-hmm. and you need to chew that stuff. It takes time.
It doesn't. It's hard to carry on a conversation, right, with your business
yeah.
colleagues.
But chewing is very important. All of our food we need to chew, and I like to just mention that from time to time because people forget.
Well, exactly, for the health of our teeth and our digestive system. Absolutely, chew that food up.
Mm-hmm. But I'm just looking... Just to start with, the cover of your book, you have a platter of cucumbers, tomatoes, asparagus, basil, and peppers.
Right.
And the simplest of foods, and yet beautiful on the plate. Beautiful.
I know it. I think that complementary colors like that, something in the warm family and something in the cool family, so the oranges and reds and the greens really pop when
mm-hmm.
you serve them. There's just no way they can't. So, yeah, that was my publisher and the good folks at Vegan Heritage Press that styled that, and I think it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it definitely pops. And I like the French tile in the background.
That's a topic of a whole other radio program. But that was also their decision. I didn't like the original background, and we worked and worked and worked and worked and worked to come up with something, and John Robertson came up with this white tile idea, and I just love it.
Mm-hmm.
It looks so clean
mm-hmm.
and still kitcheny,
mm-hmm.
very modern.
Yep.
And I love food against a white backdrop. So,
yeah, I love, there's a wide variety of plates out there to choose from, and yet I always go with white.
You know, Karen, I do too, and when I was shooting the photographs for the book, you know, we wanted plenty of color in the photographs, but I found that the best way to showcase the color of the
mm-hmm.
food was always on white, but I found that I would put, like, colored liner plates underneath the white
mm-hmm.
plate that was next to the food, and that always looks fun, and, you know, it's fun to shop that way, too, just whipping into Pier 1 or somewhere like that and buying some singletons in bright colors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun to play with the appearance of the food.
Okay, some of the things that I'm always talking about, reiterating, being redundant, repeating myself, et cetera, because I'm trying to make a point, and
yes.
people need to hear it over and over to get it, is the importance of organic, locally grown, fresh food.
Oh, yes, I totally agree.
And eating seasonally.
Yes, and, you know, I have to tell you that what my kind of goal for myself is now is to only buy things like my vegan dairy products and paper products at the grocery store, some, you know, like natural sugar and baking,
mm-hmm.
things like that, but to buy everything else from this farmer's market that's open year-round. You know, we have a lot of them around here, but I think you have to factor in how far you have to drive to get to them, you know, how much fuel you're burning. I drive a Prius, but you still have to factor that in. So there's one that's very near us. It's open year-round, and I try to just build my meals around whatever they've got that's seasonal, local, et cetera. So I totally agree with you.
Well, we're lucky we live in a global society, and we have access to everything.
We are.
You know, and I live in New York City, and I have access to more than everything.
Right. You do.
But, you know, we need to really pay attention and not buy things just because they're there.
Or just because you have a craving for them or whatever. Yeah, I completely agree.
I've been talking about tomatoes lately because I was horrified to find out that our winter tomatoes come from Florida and there are slaves that are literally used to grow these vegetables.
Can I ask you how you found that out? Because I think that's important for people to know, too, is how to do a little poking around and,
find
out the provenance of their food.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Well, I have a new nonprofit called Responsible Eating and Living. And if you go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, the video that we're showing right now is with the author, Barry Esterbrook, who wrote the book Tomato Land, and he did a lot of research about what's going on in Florida with tomatoes. But I think every food has a story, and you know how much can we do to investigate?
I know,
because when it comes to profiting from a product, there are always going to be people who are going to...
They bury the story, right?
Exploit and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
We learned about chocolate a while ago,
right,
about what was going on with child slaves in the Ivory Coast.
Right.
And so there are more chocolate-friendly suppliers now.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say I think every food has a story. But the best thing that we can do is know our farmers, buy locally and fresh as much as possible.
I totally agree. I just found when I made the switch from vegetarianism, which I'd been for decades, to being vegan, which is more like 5 years, I guess, it was really based on what you're talking about. It just had to do with not believing the hype about the happy cows, you know, delivering the dairy and that type of thing, and just not having the time to do research into, you know, where cows were treated as pets and also milked, you know. And so I just felt that it was more responsible to cut it out of my diet entirely. And I've never looked back. It was a great choice for me.
That's an interesting point. I remember reading something similar to that when Jonathan Safran Foer came out with his book Eating Animals several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about, because he was trying to be understanding and compassion to those who really want to eat animal foods.
Right.
And he was saying, you know, it's really easier to be vegan. Because if you want to eat, quote, humanely and get your dairy and your meat from humane sources, and I always use that word with quotation marks
exactly
around it.
I can hear it in your voice, and I agree.
It's impossible to eat 100% humanely unless you're growing your own animals and your own food, because there's not a lot of it out there, and you can't find many restaurants that are doing it 100%.
Mm-hmm. No. And like you said, when there's a profit motive there, you can't necessarily trust what you're told because you're not told so much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I completely agree. It's much, much easier.
And then
easier on the conscience, that's for sure.
Yeah, but then for those that are considering humane agriculture of animals for the environment, I think what people don't realize is there's not enough landmass on the planet for people to eat the quantities of meat and dairy they're eating today unless we...
unless it's grown like it's grown.
Intensify and cram these animals into small spaces. We cannot physically do it, and that means people need to eat less and preferably none.
Right. No, I completely agree. I live with my husband who is not a vegan, and it's not a source of huge strife. He's, you know, an adult, but he buys his own meat and he prepares his own meat, and we just eat completely separate meals. But, you know, I do wish that he and others would do much more research and the work required to get their food from, as you say, humane in quotation sources.
Were you vegan before you got married?
I was not.
Yeah.
No, so it was false advertising. In fact, I think I became completely vegetarian. I quit eating beef and pork when I was 17, and it was a dietary decision then, and it gradually became about animal rights. And then I gradually cut out chicken, and I think it was probably about 18 years ago that I stopped eating fish, but we had gotten married 21 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, It's challenging because food is so important, and especially in social situations.
Yes, but it's so personal, but it's so political. And, you know, I was listening to one of your just promotional pieces, I guess, between your previous guest and me, and it was the Godspeed Institute, I think. But anyway, just the idea that that everything at its core is spiritual or ethical. And, you know, food is so critical to all of us. The idea that you'd make decisions about it that were not ethically based is just sort of inconceivable to me.
Did I say it's all about food before?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it's all about food, everything.
All about food, absolutely. And I don't want to sound moralistic or judgmental, but, you know, for me that is sort of what it boils down to, but I don't always mention that in all settings.
So anyway, you have a very lovely book. It's got some very lovely recipes. I'm just thumbing through it, and I notice you use some instant tea in one of your dressings, a sweet tea dressing.
Yes, yes, you just steep it.
I love tea in food.
I do, too. And, you know, now I probably wouldn't have used the instant version. I probably would have done a steep tea like I did.
Sure.
There's a frosting for some pear cupcakes in the cookbook, and it's a steeped tea frosting. But it's such a subtle and delicate and yet complex flavor. I just love it.
Well, I don't like to use oil very much, and so I saute a lot in water or in tea.
Oh, what a great idea.
And there's one tea. It's very intense. It's a combination of a lapsang and a Russian tea, and it's very unpleasant to drink.
But is it good for sautéing?
Great for sautéing. It has a really hefty, meaty, smoky flavor to it.
Oh, it sounds perfect. Yeah, that's such a great idea. I don't do that. I still use olive oil, but I think I'll experiment with that a bit.
Oh, sure.
In fact, every recipe in the cookbook starts with heating a tablespoon of olive oil in a cast iron skillet. I think just about every single one.
Well,
I was going to tell you, since you had mentioned eating seasonally and locally, and of course that's what the whole book is about, another one of the brilliant strokes by my publisher was to identify the seasons with these icons that are in the corners of each page. And so when you're flipping through the appetite section, you can flip right away to what's fall, spring, winter, summer.
Oh, that's nice.
By the icon. Yeah,
right.
We thought that was just
clever.
Great. We had talked about organizing it by the season, but then people would have a hard time finding, you know, a soup or an appetizer or whatever. So this worked out great.
Oh, it really is a good idea because how do I put this tactfully?
Oh, why be tactful?
You know, people don't want to read. People don't want to take any time. They want it to be fast and visual, and this is a winner.
It is fast and visual, and I think the icons are really cute. In fact, I had a graphic designer friend design some book plates that I will be happy to send to people who purchase the book that I can sign and personalize, and she used all the icons on the little book plates, so they're really cute.
One of the big things that people that talk about vegan diets and say that they can't do it because they're going to miss cheese. And we have lots of different cheese alternatives. I'm not a fan of the packaged ones in the store. But
I'm
they're
so glad you said that. Me either.
I want to knock any of those brands and people.
No, of course not. I'm glad they offer what they do.
They're not good.
No, I don't like them texture-wise, taste-wise.
Yeah.
None of the above.
But get back in the kitchen, please, folks. There is just so many great cheesy recipes, and I'm looking at your blue cheese sauce here.
Yes.
That's good with my favorite sesame tahini. Tahini on anything.
Isn't it good?
It is fabulous, and it's filled with vitamin E and all kinds of great nutrition. But this is great. It's got a little beer in it.
That was my sort of contribution to the world of vegan cheeses, I think. I mean, I hadn't seen it before, and maybe somebody else had done it, but I was, you know, in the development process of the cookbook and desperate to find some ingredient that would give it that deeper fermented taste, a little more aged maybe, and racking my brain and needing to test a recipe and remember that my husband had some beer in the fridge. Now, not all beer is vegan, but there's a wonderful, you can just Google vegan beer, and there's a wonderful article. My blog has something about it as well, but anyway, it has to do with what they process it with for clarifying. But at any rate, the beer, it's a great, great, great addition to these cheeses made from nuts. I have some in the book that, or one, I guess, that's made from white bean, but there are others that are made from cashews, and I've since been using macadamias when I want a whiter-looking cheese spread. And, you know, it's so easy. You just dilute them a little more with soy milk or, you know, your favorite vegan dairy milk, I mean non-dairy milk, and or the beer, and then you can use it more as a sauce and drizzle it, or you can kind of break it up and dollop it. So it's so flexible, and I have so many non-vegan friends that love it. And I haven't had cheese in so long, I don't know that I exactly remember what it tastes like. But, you know, side-by-side comparison, you would know the difference. But I think what people need to understand about vegan food is that you've got to appreciate it for its own specific profile, you know, and flavor notes.
it is what it is, and it's I like it best when it's not trying to be something else.
It doesn't have to taste the same. What people are looking for is fat and salt.
Right.
And
exactly
this is,
right.
You know, one version. And, you know, I'm thinking macadamia and some other nuts like pine nuts tend to be a little pricey.
Yes.
But when you think about a lot of cheeses, some
super
of
pricey.
They're exceptionally expensive. And
even
so
the vegan ones, too, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I find myself just craving them. And one of the ingredients I know that I crave, besides the oil and the salt, is nutritional yeast.
Oh, love
I just
it.
Think
mm-hmm.
it is the golden powder from the gods. I love it.
Yes, and if you get your Red Star version, it has B12 in it, which we all need.
Which we all need, right?
Yeah.
That's a good tip. I never go anywhere without it. I have a shaker bottle in the bottom of my backpack.
I don't leave home without it.
Yes, you can mm-hmm. just, you know, fill that baby up and sprinkle it on, you
yeah.
know, some ridiculous restaurant meal that's
it's a
not very balanced.
It just has a multi-dimensional flavor.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's quite a good thing.
Yep. I totally agree with you, and I love it on popcorn at the movie.
So we just have a few minutes left. Do you have some favorites in here?
You know, it's sort of like picking a favorite child, or in my case, a favorite dog. My husband and I don't have children, but we've got a bunch of dogs that are being very good, and they're not barking in the background. I guess for winter, let's see, in the appetizer department, there's an Indian sog dip. It's on page 35.
Mm.
And I use tofu in it to give it a body that's more like a dip or a spread, and, of course, protein as well. And it is just delicious and a little different, you know. You get sog easily at an Indian restaurant, but you don't often find it as an appetizer, you know, on someone's buffet.
Right, or vegan.
Exactly mm-hmm. right. And I love spinach in anything. So if you have the book there on page 72,
yes.
there's a spanakopita soup. And I love spanakopita, you know, but it's kind of heavy and it's got a lot of the phyllo and it's real buttery.
Yeah.
And so just to kind of reduce all of that, I use the phyllo as croutons over the top of it. So you
okay.
get that crunch and
mm-hmm.
that butteriness, but you don't
not too much.
Kill yourself in the calorie and fat department.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
We just have a couple of minutes left,
sure.
and you're a teacher. Do you share any of this food
Absolutely.
Art with your students?
Yeah, you know, I got our PE teacher who teaches the health unit asked me to come and do a presentation that was filmed by our computer resource teacher and then shown to all of her classes, and just great, great, great feedback from that. And in fact, just yesterday I got an email from a student who's now in college, a freshman, and she said that she's been vegetarian for the past 3 months, and she credits me with making the switch. So, yeah.
That always feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'll share nutritional information with my kids' parents who are a little bit worried about whether they'll get the proper nutrients, because,
mm-hmm.
of course, they will. So, yes, it's very much a part of who I am as a teacher as well.
Well, that's important because especially with the cutbacks in schools.
Yeah.
You're lucky that your school has art to begin with, but
our district is so committed to our art program, and yes, I am very lucky.
It's a crazy thing because we know that art is so important to learning and for children and for growing creativity. It doesn't make any sense at all that would be cut. But also, nutrition rarely gets discussed. I mean, there's little pockets here and there where there's more information, but so important,
you know,
to talk about.
I'll have to tell you really quickly, one breakthrough in our cafeteria is
mm-hmm.
they're no longer serving French fries, and the standard lunch of kids in the lunch line was pizza and French fries, and they cannot get
wow.
French fries anymore. So I think that's a great step
that
forward.
That is, especially since we recently heard that the USDA was considering...
Oh, a vegetable?
Considering it a vegetable.
Yes, and because tomato ketchup is too...
Well, Betsy, it was great talking to you, and I'm really enjoying your cookbook, The Blooming Platter. You have a wonderful website called theBloomingPlatter.com with a few fun puns as headings, the Mad Platter and what's
much.
The Platter. That's
yes.
always fun, a little humor.
Oh, yes. Got to keep it light. That's the point.
Thanks for joining me on It's
been
All
a
About
joy.
Food.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Okay, you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, talking about my favorite subject, food. And please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. So many more recipes and good information up there. Have a delicious week. And next week, we're going to be talking to John Schlim, who wrote the book, The Tips. see vegan. I think more recipes with beer and other alcoholic beverages. And the second part will be Vegan Pie in the Sky with Terry Romero and Issa Moskowitz. We'll be back next week. Have a delicious one. Until then, bye-bye.